南無妙法蓮華経。南無妙法蓮華経。Today we finish the Vimalakirti Sutra. Hi everyone, I hope this finds you in good health and secure. This has been a real joy to read as a reminder that I don't know. I promise I'll keep this short. It's just in the nature of any organization, and let me define that as, you know, we get together as a sangha, right? Like-minded people, all studying, trying to improve our depth of understanding and cull our insights to solidify, to gain confidence and determination and actuate our Buddha-ness, yeah? And practice with sincere, we're tired of habits and repetitive. It seems like we're not in control of our life. We're Buddhists because we want to control, have some say, have some influence in our own lives, for crying out loud, yeah? So that, to me, that's not an organization. An organization like an institution, right? We may be organized in that we have our own schedules to get together, watch these videos, talk about things, so on and so forth. But when I say organization, I mean hierarchies. I mean those groups that identify as a group, not as individuals. Yeah, you can play with that rhetoric all day long. Yeah, we're all individuals, but we're all part of, under, up. No. If there's an identifiable organization, I don't mean a leader, although the two sometimes go hand in hand. The organization actually trumps the leader. No pun intended there. But it is the function of an organization, to take care of itself first. And everything that it does and everything that it promotes and the leaders of that organization promote and disseminate is geared to remove any influences outside of what benefits the organization. So right off the bat, it's not Buddhist. What did Shakyamuni tell us? 3,000 years ago, almost. You have to practice for yourself. You have to study all of Buddhist scholarship and non-Buddhist. Because only then will you be able to cultivate your insights with absolute surety. See, when your insights are clear, and they're yours, then they're not just going along or rhetorical or, what's the word, I just had it. They're not opinion anymore. You don't want to have opinions about Buddhism. You want to be absolutely certain about your practice of Buddhism. So when a group, an organization, or even a person tells you, just read our books, don't read theirs, just read this book, don't read those, just read the Lotus Sutra, don't read those other sutras, how does that square with the word? And the thing is, if you've practiced Nichiren in any form amongst all of the sects or groups, how can you justify in your mind reading Nichiren saying and quoting Shakyamuni as saying study broadly and still do what you're told, just read this? Anyway, I promised I'd keep it short. So the reason I say that is because this last chapter of the Vimalakirti, and it's already happened several times, I'm sure if you've, I'm sure I pointed it out, but just you're paying attention on your own, almost like sound bites, word for word, there are statements in this Vimalakirti years ahead of the Lotus Sutra that are word for word what is in the Lotus Sutra, or even in Nichiren's doctrines, but he quotes all of these, so of course, right? My point being is that this man, Shakyamuni, taught for over 50 years, and although he taught to the capacity of the people he was speaking to, right? When you teach a four-year-old about math, you speak differently about math than when you teach a 10-year-old or a 20-year-old or a 30-year-old about math, because they have different capacities. It's simple. We experience this, so we have a high degree of confidence, yeah? But math doesn't change. The nature of adding 2 + 2 doesn't change when you're 4 years old, 10 years old, 20 years old. There's a lot more complexity and nuance to discover. But the message is still number of values, equations, calculations. They're just more evolved, more nuanced, more profound, right? So this is what we find with Shakyamuni's teachings. It's become super obvious, especially as we have the thesis, the PhD thesis, right? We have the Lotus Sutra, and we have our great mentor, Nichiren, showing us, dissecting the Lotus Sutra and all the scholarship that led up to it. And so when we go back, and yes, we read and study outside of the Lotus Sutra, yeah, we do what Shakyamuni and all the scholarship has told us to do. Study broadly, because it helps us with, and here's an insight. Oh my goodness. Decades earlier teachings in Mahayana and even all the way to the Agama Sutras, the foundations are placed. They never change. Shakyamuni was teaching the same thing his entire life, just to different capacities. And for us, students of the final ultimate teaching, it's kind of, I was going to say enlightening, don't want to overuse that word, but it's really confidence building to go and read earlier sutras and see where these thoughts that we thought were completely fully developed and exist only in the Lotus Sutra and some are, the self-practice. But even the self-practice, the self-actualizing method of enlightenment, it's throughout every, it's from the moment Shakyamuni spoke the Four Noble Truths, he was talking about enlightening yours. You want to know how to stop suffering? Then stop doing this. How do you stop doing this? Live like this. He was teaching self-enlightenment from the get-go. But as is the nature of human beings, we glom on to the words and the rituals and all the other stuff, and we keep losing sight of what the hell we're doing it for. Now, when you chant Namo Myoho Renge Kyo, it's not a lot of room to stray. It's pretty direct. Thank goodness for that. Otherwise, we're still doing it, right? Not you and I, but I mean human beings in general. We can be given the most exquisite answer to everything, and we'll still be bouncing around going, yeah, but what about the ketchup on the ice cream thing? You know, stay focused. And ain't that the name of the game? So all of that is to introduce the last chapter, which is called, of all things, entrustment. Is this a theme we see often in sutras? Mm-hmm. It's how Shakyamuni basically ends a lesson, a sermon. Now that I've exposed all of this to you, so you have lots to chew on and solidify your practice with, let me now make you responsible for it. You know what to do? Now do it. Wow. How nuanced is that? How long did it take to develop that way of teaching? Has it always been here? Isn't that how knowledge gets transferred from one to another? I can imagine a Neanderthal sharpening a stone with a flint and making a spearhead, showing somebody else, and then handing them a rock and a stick or whatever, and saying, do it. Right? It wasn't invented in the Bodhisattvas of the Earth chapters of the Lotus Sutra. The nature of the teaching had greatly expanded and become much more focused on the methodology. But listen, this Virmanakirti, we've been talking about bodhisattva behavior, how to behave like a bodhisattva, how to think like a bodhisattva, how to inculcate our Buddha-ness in our lives in samsara. The whole Virmanakirti could be summed up in a couple of chapters of the Lotus Sutra. It's just being taught in a different way, in a different expedient means. But nothing in this sutra has deviated. It isn't like, oh, wow, that's totally different than the Lotus Sutra. Well, it's only different in its methodology of doing the exact same thing. You and I are ready to just instantiate Buddhahood. This is still coddling people who aren't quite getting it, Shravakas and Pratyekabuddhas, that the nature of bodhisattva isn't just being a nice person. It's an actualizing in this samsaric life of another mind, a different mind, a cleared mind, an experience of observation, not ego. Not I'm doing this, I know this. It's about this being known. And I'm conducting my life with that knowledge, with that knowing. It's not mine. It's pre-existing. That's a different position for the same knowledge. I hope that's obvious. I hope that that's one of the things you're getting out of this exercise of going through other sutras. So, with all of that blah, 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 I haven't said that in a while, entrustment. Then the Buddha addressed the Bodhisattva Maitreya. Now, we've thrown around this word Buddha a lot, especially in this story. There have been many, but the whole time, as I've pointed out, has been Shakyamuni putting himself in the personage of other characters in order to teach his listeners who he's trying to remove their reticence, their idea that, yeah, but you're Shakyamuni. So already they've removed themselves from the potential of accomplishing what he's accomplished. They're not getting it. So they're perennial students. They'll never master. So he's like, okay, it's not me telling you this. Well, it's a mental device because everyone's sitting there and they're seeing him talking. But he's saying, there's this guy. His name's Vimalakirti. And this is what he says. And so that simple device, skillful means, right? Expedient means, whatever you want to call it. His storytelling capacity, capability, is to take your mind, my mind, the mind of those people who were listening to him and saying, don't take it from me. Take it from this guy. The guy's imaginary, but gosh, our brains are so amazing at personalizing and identifying things. The minute he says, there's this guy, we're all thinking, what's he look like? How tall is he? Does he have a long beard, a short beard? Is he blonde? Is he brown? We're making him so. And so Shakyamuni says, go ahead. He's Vimalakirti, he's rich, he's benevolent, he's so smart. And now everybody's like, oh, if only I could be like Vimalakirti. In fact, none of them want to go check on him in this story because they're not worthy. Vimalakirti, he's so amazing. But it's still an attainable because Vimalakirti is just some rich guy. Whereas Shakyamuni, oh, he's Buddha. I could never do that. So Shakyamuni makes this story so that the teachings he's giving them will be more palatable, more easily integrated into their success of practice. But as we also noted, Shariputra having a really hard time with that. He knows all the stories. Oh, yeah, he's a great scholar. But he's still, his ego, his identification as, I'm a great student. He may be a great student of knowing stuff, but he's not owning it. He's owning his studentship, not his Buddha-ness. It's really tough to get past that. That's why for so many years of his teachings, Sravakas and Pratyagabuddhas, or Hinayana practitioners, were looked upon as unable to attain enlightenment because of their own stubbornness, right? Until the Lotus Sutra, where he says, okay, if you can get your head out of your butt just for a moment, just do this, then all of that stuff, you know, will actually come to fruition and do something. It won't be about you, right? Anyway, so now he's dropping the pretense and he's saying, okay, he addresses Bodhisattva Maitreya, one of the senior disciples, right? And he says, Maitreya, I now take this law of Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi, gathered over countless millions of Asamkaya Kalpas, and entrust it to you. So just in that statement alone, there's the validation for what I've been saying. Shakyamuni is taking this fundamental nature of all phenomena, this perfect, complete experience, awakening, it's where they talk about the Buddha eye. It's vision, but it's not vision in the idea of visual consciousness. It's vision in the mind of an understanding, of an observer, witness to the process of all phenomena, which is without time. And he's saying, this is why he's saying the law, which is the perception of this truth, has been gathered over countless millions of asamkhya kalpa. That's the life of the universe. This action of energy manifesting karma moment to moment to moment that's been going on since time without beginning, this awakening to that in the mind, I hand to you. It's not mine, Shakyamuni. It's this law. In the latter age, after the Buddha has passed into extinction, sound familiar? You must employ your supernatural powers to propagate sutras such as this, spreading them throughout the continent of Jambudvipa and never allowing them to be wiped out. You must share this great vehicle teaching broadly, lest it be forgotten. This is a constant theme in the sutras, right? This is why the Gandhari people, that area of northeastern India, Pakistan, the whole area now is several different countries are playing in that geographic region. But, you know, Google Gandhara, however you want to pronounce it. There have been some books in recent years about the large amount of transliterations into several languages of the sermons of Shakyamuni Buddha in that region. And much of what motivated them, of those people, to transcribe and to purchase to the elite, there's always the elite, would hire transcribers who had a talent for it. And they would transcribe all of these things, write it down, right? Read, recite, write down, disseminate. And they would fold up their beautiful writings in whatever languages they had their own in the Dharani region and put them into big clay pots and bury them in the ground. That was a ceremonial thing to make sure that the teachings would not be lost over time. This is a constant refrain. And you and I, Bodhisattvas of the earth, have the mission in the Lotus Sutra given to us to do the same, to propagate this teaching, because in this age of degeneration, and look at all the, I've talked about the distractions that are constant in this time, something like this teaching could easily just evaporate, never be seen again. How many have done before of different teachings, yeah? So it's incredibly important to propagate. But as I've also said, by practicing deeply with conviction, we ourselves are propagators simply by being in our environments, associating with others. We influence them and the curiosity builds and the propagation happens quite naturally. That is being a bodhisattva, a much more profound definition than what was understood in earlier civilizations. Yeah? Okay. So he says it right here. You must propagate this and never allowing them to be wiped out, these teachings. Because in the ages to come, there will be good men and good women, as well as heavenly beings, dragons, all the different mind capacities, yes, capabilities, and others, who will set their minds on attaining Anuttara Samyak Sambodaya and will delight in the great law, the Mahayana law, the knowledge of this witnessing that is universal. Yes? If they are unable to hear sutras such as this, they will lose the opportunity to gain excellent rewards, an excellent life. They will fall into samsara. They will fall into the lower realms. Yeah? Attachment. Even if they're good people trying to reach enlightenment, if they're doing it via attachments, they'll never get there. So this teaching is essential to break through that barrier. This is what he's saying. This teaching and teachings like it. So he's talking about all of Mahayana. Yeah? But if beings such as these hear these sutras, they will surely believe and delight greatly in them and set their minds on a rare achievement. Therefore, you must respectfully accept these, and considering how living beings can best gain benefits from them, expound them far and wide. Does this not sound a lot like the exhortations, the entrustment chapter of the Lotus Sutra, talking to Bodhisattvas of the future, Bodhisattvas of the earth, you and I? It's the same rhetoric, yeah? Maitreya, you should understand that there are two types of Bodhisattvas. Oh, I want to hear this. What are these two types? The first type loves varied phrases and literary embellishments. Loves the stories, loves the words, spreads the words, talks the stories, but never says anything but the story. There's something missing. You get it? Like the Sharvaka, can memorize all the sermons, can quote them chapter and verse to you, read them out loud, say them with you, read and recite them. But is he actualizing it? Or is he just a damn good student? So, the first type of bodhisattva loves varied phrases and literary embellishments. The second is not afraid of deeper principles and is able to enter into the true meaning. How often have we talked about that? It's a great story, but what's it really about? What's it mean? What are the implications to my experience of life? If there are those who love varied phrases and literary embellishments, you may be sure that they are beginners in the Bodhisattva way. Oh, okay, so it's acceptable to be that way, but it's certainly not the rare achievement he was talking about earlier, is it? When we first start practicing, that's kind of where we are. We're just trying to wrap our heads around these stories. Like the turtle and the sandalwood log, right? But who among us, in our latter age of development, doesn't start abstracting meaning right away when we read a story? That's where the key is. That's why we have a different capacity, yeah? But if there are those who, approaching these extremely profound sutras with their teachings on non-defilement and non-attachment, are not timid or fearful, but can enter into the meaning, and having heard the sutras with pure minds, will accept, uphold, read, recite, and practice them as the law directs, you may be sure that they have been practicing the way for a long time. That is to say, doesn't mean that you've been practicing Mahayana Buddhism for previous lifetimes. What it means is that the wisdom that you're experiencing is timeless. Again, Maitreya, he says, there are two attitudes among those called beginners that prevent them from getting a firm grasp on these extremely profound teachings. What are these two? First is that of persons who, when they hear something profound, some profound sutra they have not heard before, they're alarmed and timorous, and giving way to doubt, cannot bring themselves to comply with it. Oh, that's a step too far, Sifu. Yeah, you're starting to talk about things that they make me question what you're saying. That's just, like when I've talked to some of you who've asked about this experience when you're chanting to your mandala, and the mandala appears, you experience it somehow differently. And for some of you, hearing that makes you think, this sounds like magic tricks. But no, it's just not something you've experienced. You're not ready to hear that discussion because you haven't experienced it. And as I've said to you guys, those of you who are uneasy about that, I'm not making it magical. I'm simply saying, very scientifically, that if you have a proper altar, a proper mandala, and you chant properly, in other words, you're doing all the things as read, as directed, and you truly focus your mind. Because as you know, when we chant to this mandala, we are marshaling our mind to focus our eye, our sight consciousness, our oral consciousness, listening to keeping the words pronounced correctly, the characters pronounced correctly, the sound, the rhythm we feel in our bodies. We feel our tongue moving around in our mouth. We feel the vibrations in our body, namu myoho renge kyo, namu myoho renge kyo, right? And we focus in on those characters, myoho. Your eyes can wander around and perceive the entire mandala, but we're in that myoho region of potential manifesting, myoho, potential, ho, manifesting. And right there, we're focused, right? And we drill our attention into it. That's the beauty of this tool, because what that does is removes the distractions, visual distractions, sound distractions, bodily distractions that we deal with all day long, all the time. And so now we have this tool and we direct that focus to Buddha. Buddha, Buddha. Namo myoho renge kyo. That's what we're doing. It's an intense focus into instantiating that Buddha mind, our Buddha-ness. And what happens when we instantiate that Buddha-ness? We've talked about this many, many, many times. The nature of things starts to not be so strong on our identification. And when that happens in your mind, the mandala itself, which is a physical thing, starts to do some little visual tricks on you. Or you hear yourself. You are, in other words, simply experiencing that paradigm shift in your mind. That's all. That's not mystical. It's a real mental activity. And you can witness with your earthly senses that something's shifting, something's happening. Just like you're breathing. You're getting more oxygen in your system. You're feeling more energized. For those of you who, some of you, your eyes start to droop as you chant. It's because you're not breathing properly. You're not chanting properly. You're not engaged. That's a tough one. You have to get on yourself. Be your own best coach and go pay attention. Namo myoho renge kyo. Really drill it in there. You will feel a shift. That's not mystical. It's real. It's physiological and mental. So I'm not spooking and talking about, you know, things swirling in the air. No, no, no. This isn't a Disney movie. So don't let that kind of talk create your own doubts. But understand, our sangha is large. And some people have profound experiences, and I'm here to support them as well, to share my experiences, right? To know, are we practicing correctly? We're always asking this question of ourselves, aren't we? Is this doing anything? Is it really working? Am I doing it right? That's what the sangha is for. So sometimes my responses or my insights might shock you even, or make you, but that's your karma. Please recognize that's not me doing that. That's just your current state of resolve, understanding, depth of practice. So try, please try not to judge me and use that as a doubt in your practice. That's Dairaku Tenomao, isn't it? Use what you can. Develop your own insight. This is your practice. Follow? So let's continue. So when they hear some profound sutra they've not heard before, are alarmed and timorous, giving way to doubt, cannot bring themselves to comply with it. Right? That's an early stage of bodhisattva. In their disbelief, they speak slanderously of it, saying, I've never heard this before. Where does it come from? This is what I'm cautioning you not to do. Because that's what we do. Whenever something new comes up, we either go, wow, that's great, let me try it. Or we go, huh. And we talk shit about it. You know me, I'm a plain talker. Try to avoid doing that. Maybe there's something there. You just need to hear it a different way at a different time. Maybe experience it for yourself and then go, that's what that loon was talking about. Right? Isn't life like that? Haven't we done this our whole lifetime? Retrack our steps and go, yeah, maybe I should have waited before I spouted my opinion all over the place. Made some bad causes doing that. Maybe just calm down. Wait. Best of all, chat about it. In other words, use that question as motivation to chant. Let me correct my own language there, yeah? Second is that of persons who, though they are those who guard, uphold, understand, and expound profound sutras of this type, are unwilling to associate closely with them, to offer them alms or treat them with respect, but at times may even speak of their faults before others. That's kind of a modification of the same thing. Like a Sravaka, you may be very knowledgeable about all of these Mahayana sutras, all of the sutras, but you're not entirely convinced because you're not really practicing. You're just a tourist of sorts. You're studying it. You're pretty darn knowledgeable. But every time you talk about it to somebody, It's like you're afraid to be accused of it or something. And you tell people, yeah, you know, that's what the sutra says. I mean, make of it what you will. Try not to be dismissive. Just because you haven't experienced something yet doesn't mean it doesn't exist, yeah? Until you really hunker down, it's kind of like going to college or even high school. If you take a class or some, you know, other, I don't care, maybe a clay pot class at your community college. You can go in there and slap around the clay and take the tests and get the grades that you know how clay works and the different types of firings for the clay. But, you know, you're never really into it. And you can talk about it and, oh, you know about pot throwing? Oh, yeah, I know what you do, blah, 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 blah. But until you've challenged yourself to create things with that clay in that potting class that you can feel proud of having been involved in its making, and that it succeeds and it fails and you learn more and you succeed or fail again. Until you go through that intimate relationship with the teaching, you really don't know. You're still in the physical world of working with clay. You don't understand that transcendent moment of, gosh, that's beautiful. But it's not just beautiful on its own. It's beautiful because of the intense relationship you built with it. And it's now come to fruition. That's a different kind of knowing, isn't it? Where you find these two attitudes, you may be sure the persons are beginners in the Bodhisattva way. Because that's our natural tendencies, yeah? Because of identification. For those starting out, oftentimes, there's the implication, because of the amazing nature of Buddhaness, that it stands in opposition to ourselves. And it does. Because our self, our ego, is what's in the way. But at first, the conviction of that, the security of knowing that, is intimidating. And so what do human beings do when they feel intimidated? They always try to put the other in its place. Yeah, it's great and all, but, you know, I do this. They do injury to themselves and cannot train their minds to accept the profound teaching. So it's going to happen, right? I can sit here and say, please don't do that, but I don't know you. You may naturally not do that. You may naturally go, man, this is amazing. I can't wait to experience this. I know I can do it. Good. But you may be still in the throes of, yeah, maybe. And that's the degree of confidence, conviction that you have in your practice. And the truth is, we're roller coasters. Sometimes we feel like, damn, my life is different. This is amazing, this practice. And then some obstacle comes up and you like, I didn't think this would ever happen again, or ever happened to me, right? Like the universe happening to us, life happening to us. And I've corrected that many times. You've heard me say it. Life does not happen to you. It happens for you because it's a reflection of your moment-to-moment instantiating being. Again, Maitreya, there are two attitudes among the bodhisattvas who, though they believe and understand the profound teachings, yet do injury to themselves and are unable to accept the truth of birthlessness. What are these two? First is that of persons who are contemptuous of beginner bodhisattvas and will not teach them or enlighten them. Right? Oh, God. No, you know, I know Nichiren Buddhism. I just do this. No, you don't know. And then they're tired. Oh, I can't deal with you. Or worse, you're too stupid. Right? I mean, human beings. So yeah, there's that kind of, and these are bodhisattvas practicing. So don't be too hard on yourself, right? Second is that of persons who, though they understand the profound teachings, seize upon surface appearances and make distinctions. These are the two attitudes. Right? Oh, those are just magic words. You've heard me talk about that plenty. They're not magic words. They're not even words. They're conceptual containers. Myoho renge kyo. What you just heard me say a moment ago, myo is potential, ho is instantiation, manifestation. Those potential manifestations, those are words we use to define a huge concept. It's the concept that we want to seize upon, not the freaking words. But we're samsaric beings, so we use sounds and language and so forth to express and experience something. Yeah? The Bodhisattva Maitreya, after listening to these words of exposition, addressed the Buddha saying, quote, "World-honored one, this is something I've never heard before. It is as the Buddha said, I must remove myself far off from the evil, the lower realms, such as these, and strive to uphold the law of Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi, that the thus come one has gathered over numberless asamkhaya kalpas." And you notice he didn't say Shakyamuni, he didn't say Buddha, he said thus come one, that Tathagata timeless perspective. If in the ages to come there are good men and good women who seek the great vehicle, I will see to it that sutras such as this come into their hands, will lend them powers of memorization, and will cause them to accept, uphold, read, and recite the sutras and expound them far and wide for others. World-honored one. If in that latter age there are those who can accept, uphold, read, recite, and expound them for others, you should know that all of them will do so because I inspired them and strengthened them with my supernatural powers. So who's Maitreya at this point? He's not some guy with a weird name running around convincing people. He is the teaching itself, spreading. As I said before, if you focus on your Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi and your Buddha-ness, you will influence others. You just will. Because that's the nature of an ultimate truth. It doesn't need explanation. But to samsaric beings, it needs to be pointed out. Because we're so wrapped in our world of identification. The Buddha said, "Excellent, excellent, Maitreya. It is as you have said, and the Buddha will assist you in your joyful task." Buddha-ness, yes. With all of the, with this, all the bodhisattvas pressing their palms together said to the Buddha, quote, "After the thus come one has passed into extinction, we too will spread the law of Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi far and wide throughout the lands in the 10 directions, and will guide and assist those who expound the law, seeing it to it that they acquire this sutra." Now, they're saying this sutra, but many times Shakyamuni said sutras like this. He's talking about the Mahayana. But these bodhisattvas, now it's a translation, could be an error. But they're saying, we'll make sure they acquire this sutra. I would say that's probably a fault of interpretation, translation, yeah? Because Shakyamuni has been abundantly clear. But doesn't this sound a lot like the Bodhisattvas of the Earth entrustment chapters in the Lotus Sutra? Yeah? Moving on. Then the four heavenly kings said to the Buddha, world-honored one, in the towns and villages, the mountains, forests, the broad plain, wherever those who possess this sutra, read and recite it, understand and expound it. We will take our ranks of officials and underlings and go there where they so we may hear the law and will shelter and protect them, making certain that no one approaches within 100 yohanas of them on any side to try to take unfair advantage of them. They will incur the protections of the essence of life because they will be practicing it purely without distraction. Then the Buddha said to Ananda, his cousin, you must accept and uphold this sutra and propagate it far and wide. Because Ananda's a shravaka. You have to accept it. You have to hear it, inculcate it. Uphold it and propagate it. How many times does he hammer this, right? And this is what we do when we chant. We read, recite, uphold, actuate it, and tell others about it. This is the practice. Nichiren did not invent this. This is Shakyamuni's teaching. Just to restate that for those of you who might not remember. The Buddha said, Ananda replied, indeed, I will. I have already accepted and upheld its essentials. World-honored one, but by what name should this sutra be called? The Buddha said, Ananda, this sutra should be called the Expositions of Vimalakirti. They're really the Expositions of Shakyamuni, aren't they? But through Vimalakirti, he presents an expedient means of teaching to others in a relatable man-to-man or woman-to-you-get-it form. Because Shakyamuni at this point is seen as this, right? Shakyamuni, great sage. He's some other type of human being. So he uses Vimalakirti as a straw man. To say, he's just like you and me. There's no difference. And another name for it is the Doctrine of Emancipation Beyond Comprehension. If you got to be scholarly, this is how you should accept and uphold it. When the Buddha had finished expounding the sutra, the rich man Vimalakirti, Manjushri, Shariputra, Ananda, and all the others, along with the heavenly and human beings, Asuras, and all the other members of Great Assembly, were filled with joy at hearing the preaching of the Buddha. And then in parentheses here, or in brackets, because not all translations have this part of the sentence. And they believed and accepted it and respectfully put it into practice. Well, yeah, it's like a footnote, isn't it? But basically, like any other sutra, there's a rejoicing of having had this amazing teaching shared with them. And that's the end of the Vimalakirti Sutra. Did you notice how many parallels there are with things we've read in many other sutras? Although other sutras focus in on certain other aspects of everything we discussed, the Vimalakirti covers a huge swath of Buddhist teachings in a very simplified form in this teaching. Other teachings, like the perfection of wisdom, really drill down into certain aspects of what we talked about here. Those are very early Mahayana, right? And they change form over time. And where you put these on a timeline, it really becomes irrelevant. Knowing that they all lead to the ultimate teachings is really the overriding point. And that the Lotus Sutra represents the last 8 years of Shakyamuni's teaching, saying, now that you know all this, do as I have done, as I've been trying to get you to understand all along. And this is the simplest way to do it. Just do this. And Nichiren comes along for us in this modern age and goes, let me remind you of what Shakyamuni was saying here. And here's some tools for you to do exactly what he's told you to do. Because we live in the age of such insane distractions. Let me give you something to direct all those distractions to so you can get that freaking focus and open that gate, Gohanzan, to your Buddha-ness. And then just invoke it. You don't have to go run laps and do all these things. Just invoke it. This is targeted, active action and energy. This is karmic practice. Namo Myo Renge Kyo. Modifying all my energies toward this one enlightenment. That's what we're doing. All right. Thank you. I don't even know how long I went. Thank you. Thank you for listening. Please remember to like and subscribe. That helps our Bodhisattva mission get this knowledge, this activity that we're doing in the hands of more people, more eyeballs. It's part of our Bodhisattva practice. That's why this channel is here. Also, don't forget the website. All the links are in the video, beginning and end, so you know what to do. Your support is amazing. Your practice is mind-blowing. So thank you for that, primarily. And those of you who can support this channel with a little bit more, we're all really grateful for the patrons on Patreon, through Patreon, and the PayPal donations, paypal.me/sifusylvain. All goes into keeping the equipment working and paying the internet bills and all of that kind of crap. But yeah, I say crap because it's the material world, but we exist in it and it's requisite for us to attain enlightenment. So I don't mean to be dismissive. It's just sometime annoying that we have to go through so many hoops in order to simply communicate, evolve, and love one another. Yeah. So thank you. Take care of your health. Love yourself. That sounds easy, but I know many of you understand what that means. And be safe. I'll see you in the next one. I'm not sure if I'm going to go in deep into the mandalas. I've mentioned that before. Let me know what you think in the comments. Should I spend several videos talking about the varied mandalas that Nichiren created? The timeline, is it really that big of an obstacle to get by? I make a big deal of it. It has to be a proper mandala. Otherwise, I mean, you might as well put a chip of paint and rip off the directions off of a can of, I don't know, whatever. And, focus on that. What's that going to get you? Obviously, you want the correct, the most accurate mandala Nichiren created. Otherwise, why use it? So yeah, I'm kind of obsessive about that, right? I'm not going to put a Metropolitan magazine page with the directions on how to kiss a girl up on in my butsudan and chant to that. It makes as much sense to me as using some of these. Anyway. Do I need to talk about that more? Would it be nurturing to talk about that more? Do you want to know about that? Not just my opinion, but empirically. I mean, there are workshops right now studying the 125 extant mandalas that still exist by Nichiren's hand. Some of them pretty frail. And then there's the digital reproduction of those, right? As opposed to mandalas created by Bob and Alice and Stuart. Although they have nice hierarchical positions in their groups and organizations, they're not Nichiren. They assume they are. And that to me, that's what makes me very upset. You want to know more about that? Let me know in the comments. You don't really care? Then I'll find something else, a different sutra to talk about. Yeah. In the meantime, be kind to yourself. Keep your practice going. And I'll see you in the next one, okay? Bye for now.